From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Because everybody thinks of me as a person who's so strong. Well, I am, but not necessarily in that way.
Today, Latino icons, people who've inspired generations, including the legendary Rita Moreno, and the people who represent something bigger than themselves, for better or for worse, like La Malinche.
And so I think the whole idea is to show that Malinche should not be accused of being a traitor.
Plus a new musical about Roberto Clemente, and of course, remembering Chespirito, El Chavo del Ocho. All this and more coming up as we talk Latino icons on this Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Si siempre dice que sí, pero sabes que no. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In Mexico, there's a morning show on a local TV channel, Canal 11. It's called Diálogos, or Dialogues. It's sort of like Good Morning America. The show looks at trends or issues that are specific to Mexican culture.
Ser malichista es
la negación de la idiosincrasia nacional.
In this segment, Diálogos asked random people on the street about what it means to be a malinchista. A malinchista is basically a traitor, specifically someone who denies their own culture, in this case, your own Mexican culture, in favor of another. Malinchista comes from La Malinche, the name of an indigenous Nahua woman who lived in the early 16th century in Mexico. But even though everyone on the street in Mexico could easily answer what a Malinchista is, almost no one could say who La Malinche was.
La Malinche.
La Malinche?
La Malinche.
When the Spanish took over what is now Mexico, La Malinche acted as a translator for the Spaniards. She became the lover of conquistador Hernán Cortés. And for helping the bloody Spanish conquistadores, her name, La Malinche, has become synonymous with the word traitor. But she's also been called a victim, a visionary, and the mother of all mestizos. She's a major icon both in Mexican and in Chicano culture. So for our show today about Latino icons, our producer Antonia Cerejido tries to answer the difficult question, who was La Malinche?
Here in the U.S., we have a couple of historical figures we could compare to La Malinche, namely Pocahontas and Sacajawea, indigenous women who aided the colonizers. But what makes La Malinche larger than life, an unforgettable figure in Mexican history, is that she has been called the mother of all mestizos, mother of all the mixed-race people in Mexico, which is most of Mexico. There is a famous fresco by the muralist José Clemente Orozco in which Hernán Cortés and Malinche are both naked, sitting next to each other.
Cortés becomes, in a sense, a figure like Adam, and she is the Mexican Eve.
That's Sandra Saipes, professor at the University of Maryland and author of the book La Malinche in Mexican Literature, From History to Myth. But before La Malinche became a myth, this Eve-like figure, she was a real person.
She was really a young woman who was a slave and was given to Cortés with 20 other women, and it was her linguistic skills that brought her to the attention of Cortés.
This brought some perks.
So she was a person who had been given great respect by the Spaniards for her role as the translator, and also among the indigenous peoples because they saw her always at the side of Cortés.
As far as her romantic involvement with Cortés, the two were never married. But she and Cortés did have one child together, Martín.
This child, Martín Cortés, is called the first mestizo. And that really isn't true historically. He was not the very first child born of a Spaniard and an indigenous woman. Perhaps 9 months later, after the first Spanish came and met with the indigenous women, there were mestizos. But he perhaps could be called the first documented mestizo.
It was this role as mother that Octavio Paz, one of the most recognized Mexican writers, analyzed in an essay called Los Hijos de la Malinche, in English, The Sons of la Malinche.
The is the mother forcibly opened, violated, or deceived. The hijo de la is the offspring of violation, abduction, or deceit.
The essay was published in 1950, and as you can probably tell, it's pretty intense. Paz's main point is that because of Mexico's history and La Malinche's relationship with Cortés, Mexicans feel like they're the children of la chingada, a really bad word in Mexico that basically means a violated woman.
If the is a representation of the violated mother, it is appropriate to associate her with the conquest. And as a small boy will not forgive his mother if she abandons him to search for his father, the Mexican people have not forgiven La Malinche for her betrayal.
It is this work that establishes La Malinche as a traitor, and for lack of a better term for the radio, a loose woman, a passive woman. It also implies that the Mexican nation is made up of illegitimate children. Needless to say, this interpretation didn't sit well with everyone.
I discovered these writers, these women writers, who in a sense, it seemed to me, were responding to Paz in a sort of critical role, especially Elena Garro, who was the first wife of Octavio Paz.
Elena Garro published a short story called La Culpa de los Tlaxcaltecas in 1962.
What Elena Garro does is have the Malinche figure reject her Spanish husband and go back to her indigenous husband. And I think, in a sense, she gives her agency.
While Mexican women writers were trying to reinterpret La Malinche in Mexico, there's a whole other movement doing the same thing here in the United States. Chicana writers, Mexican-American women, are also taking on La Malinche.
Yo soy La Malinche.
This is Carmen Tafoya reading from her 1978 poem, which is appropriately called La Malinche.
I saw our world, and I saw yours, and I saw another.
She is a bridge figure, just like the Chicana would feel, as a bridge figure between different cultures.
I saw a dream, and I reached it. Another world. La raza. La raza.
La raza, the race, is used in Chicano literature to refer to the Chicano people. And Chicanos, like La Malinche, are also caught in between two cultures. In Tafoya's poem, La Malinche isn't settling for either the Aztec culture that, remember, sold her into slavery, or this colonial Spanish culture. She sees something beyond, a new society, in fact, an entirely new race. For Latino USA, I'm Antonia Cerejido.
This past October, Los Angeles City Councilman Jose Huizar took to a podium in a downtown parking lot.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming out this morning for a very important and exciting announcement as we work together to restore this beautiful mural here in downtown Los Angeles, the Pope of Broadway.
So, who is the Pope of Broadway? Well, he happens to be one of Hollywood's first Latino stars. Shara Morris tells us more.
The mural takes over the entire south wall of the five-story Victor Clothing Company. It shows a man mid-dance with his arms spanning the building's width, almost embracing the city. He looks too in the moment to pay attention to us pedestrians.
It's Anthony Quinn.
That's muralist Eloy Torres. He painted the Pope of Broadway back in 1985. The Victor Clothing Company commissioned the work as a nod to its growing Latino clientele.
We had talked about what Latino did I think that would be the equivalent of Humphrey Bogart, Fred Astaire. And so for me, it was just a no-brainer.
Today, the mural's paint has peeled, so Eloy will be scaling those five stories once again.
It's going to be interesting, I guess, maybe a little bit like a time-traveling experience, maybe. Maybe I can be 27 again. up on that wall, yeah.
The work is part of the Bringing Back Broadway initiative, an effort to revive downtown Los Angeles. City Councilman Jose Huizar says the aim is to make it pedestrian-friendly and hip.
People have used the G word, gentrification. But, you know, bringing back Broadway, I think there's enough for everyone.
Especially for fans of Anthony Quinn, like Isabel Rojas Williams, executive director of the Mural Conservancy of Los Angeles.
Anthony Quinn, you know, became one of the most glittering actors in Hollywood and the world.
Quinn was born in Chihuahua, Mexico in 1915, and soon after emigrated to the States. He was famous for inhabiting characters from all kinds of backgrounds, Mexicans, Italians, Arabs. Here he is in 1964's Lawrence of Arabia as Ayuda Abu Tayyi.
75 men have I killed with my own hands in battle. I scatter, I burn my enemies' tents. I take away their flocks and herds. The Turks pay me a golden treasure, yet I am poor. Because I am a river to my people.
In Zorba the Greek, Quinn played local islander Zorba, who teaches his British boss, played by Alan Bates, how to truly live life.
Teach me to dance. Will you?
Dance? Did you say dance? Come on, my boy.
Quinn won 2 Academy Awards for Best Supporting Actor, the first Mexican-American to do so. He worked with the greats because he was one too. Federico Fellini, Elia Kazan, Marlon Brando, Peter O'Toole. Quinn died in 2001. But we still have his films, and Angelenos have their mural. Eloy Torres says the mural's taken a life of its own.
It's become this iconic representation of the Latino populace in Los Angeles.
So who's the real icon, Anthony Quinn or the mural of Anthony Quinn?
Do you know who that is?
The face looks familiar.
It's a really big man on a wall. It just looks like it needs some work.
But it doesn't take too long to find someone who knows that face. After all, we are in the land of Hollywood.
It's Anthony Quinn doing Zorba the Greek, isn't it?
That is correct.
Well, I park there because I see the mural. It just cheers me up to see it. It's him dancing. It's that famous scene in Zorba the Greek where they're playing the Greek music and he's doing the back and forth dance, you know? Do-do-do-do-do-do-do, right?
And what does Councilman Huizar think about the mural versus the man?
That's going to be one of those unanswered questions that, like art, means different things to different people. And sometimes there is no answer. You just keep thinking about it.
Maybe there isn't an answer. But maybe both the man and the mural can teach us something. To be in the moment.
Did you say dance?
For Latino USA, I'm Shara Morris in Los Angeles.
Coming up on Latino USA, we can't talk about Latino icons without talking about Chespirito. Stay with us, no se vayan.
Ven hacia mí, que me quiero despedir.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
A great shot of that catch from Lou Powell. Here is Roberto Clemente against Cuellar in the first inning. He grounded to short.
Pittsburgh Pirates right fielder Roberto Clemente was the first Latino to be named to the Baseball Hall of Fame. He won the Gold Glove, Major League Baseball's Outfielder Award, 12 times, and he was one of only 28 Major League Baseball players to have 3,000 hits.
That is hit well. A Clemente home run, and the Pirates lead 1-0.
In Pittsburgh and around the country, there are schools, bridges, even a burger named after Roberto Clemente. And that's just the stuff we know about. Though Clemente died more than 40 years ago, you'd never know it from the hundreds of people who show up to Pittsburgh Pirates games today wearing jerseys with his name and number on them.
He's a hero. Everybody, the number 21 means a lot to everybody in Pittsburgh.
Now a new musical called 21 traces Roberto Clemente's life from his childhood in Puerto Rico to his untimely death in 1972. Erica Berras brings us the story.
21 is written by Alky Stereopoulos, a composer and baseball fan who grew up in Pittsburgh during Clemente's heyday, the 50s and 60s.
Who is this kid? A good-looking prospect. That arm is gold. I think he can hit.
Back then, Pittsburgh wasn't legally segregated, but racial tensions ran high. Clemente was one of Major League Baseball's first Afro-Latino ballplayers, coming on just a few years after Jackie Robinson. In his early days with the Pirates, Alky says Clemente caught flack from both whites who were racist and from blacks whom he criticized for taking the racism.
He was coming from a place where race didn't matter. Mixed couples had been going on for a long time. They were all Puerto Rican. There was no black and white. And he came here where we're all Americans, but there was the black and white divide was huge.
Look, Roberto, you ain't in Puerto Rico no more. Things are different up here in the land of the free. They got problems, amigo, that much is for sure. But though it ain't perfect, it's the place that you wanna be.
As 21 shows, Clemente had his share of struggles. He was repeatedly passed over for the MVP award. His English wasn't perfect, but that didn't stop him from demanding respect from racist reporters.
My English is better than your Spanish!
And so, as such, he was branded a troublemaker, arrogant, and people hated him. They said, who the heck is this uppity person coming up here that just thinks he's going to change everything and tell us what to do?
You should have seen him in spring training. Our colored boys stay separate from the regular fellas, just like all the other teams. You know that happened. Our boys don't make a squawk, not a peep out of them. But this one, you would have thought we'd asked him to stay on the moon.
One, two,
five.
Clemente never apologized for not toeing the line. Growing up, Alky watched him change people's perspectives on race.
Slowly, over the course of his life, people who were his greatest enemies came to be his biggest fans because they realized that his integrity was such, and his honesty and his refusal to suffer any fools or bad things, his refusal to take it, we all started to kind of look at ourselves differently.
Alky says Clemente's career against the backdrop of America's civil rights era set up an ideal narrative arc.
The same people that were calling him every racial epithet imaginable came to say, no, this is wrong, this guy's right. He really turned this blue-collar steel town around in a way that I think makes a difference today.
It also didn't hurt that he was such a great ball player. In his first few years, the Pirates went from being a terrible team with losing seasons through much of the 1940s and 50s to World Series champions in 1960. On opening night, the Clemente fans turn out. Among them, Arnie and Debbie Reichbaum. Arnie was at the game when Clemente made his 3,000th hit. And Debbie was teary-eyed through much of the musical.
He was a hero. You know, it was just growing up and going to the baseball games, and a lot of times I would sit out in right field in the bleachers and just... I was young, but I remember him and just screaming, Arriba, Arriba, you know, he was the great one.
Sitting behind them, wearing a 21 jersey, is Tom Bowser, who says Clemente is Pittsburgh's ideal icon.
This town has been built on what great athletes and hardworking people, and Clemente was just the perfect fit for that. He was not only the best athlete to ever play the game of baseball in Pittsburgh, but he was a great human being and a man of color in a town that didn't accept him when he first came on.
One of the ballplayer's biggest fans is his son, Luis, who says his father's most important legacy wasn't his baseball. It was his humanity.
It was always to help others, always to care for others, and that resonated with, you know, with everyone. You don't have to be a sports fan to actually engage on and believe and follow that was preaching.
In fact, that's how Roberto Clemente met an early death. He was heading to Nicaragua to deliver relief supplies to earthquake survivors. On December 31st, 1972, the plane he was on crashed. Still, despite the decades that have passed, Roberto Clemente isn't forgotten.
Well, you know what? It's amazing. Every year when we think things are going to start slowing down, it's totally the opposite. There's more schools, more places named after him.
And now there's the musical 21. For Latino USA, I'm Erica Barris in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Now, if we asked you to guess which Latin American country has emerged as a pop music icon, your guess probably wouldn't be Chile. After all, the country was under the thumb of dictator Augusto Pinochet for 17 years. But it appears that that same repressive atmosphere of the 1980s has actually helped create a pop music renaissance. Anne Hoffman explains.
Facuta is practicing for a performance at a book launch in downtown Santiago. With her black, oversized sweater and fashionably messy hair, she looks more Brooklyn hipster than who she is at her day job, Pamela Sepulveda, architect. It's all a far cry from where Facuta grew up, in a working-class barrio in the 1980s.
It wasn't so common that people went to parties.
There were a lot of anti-government protests then, and the police were everywhere. Anyone on the street could get hit with a stray rubber bullet or a water cannon. Facuta's main connection to the outside world came through a box in her living room.
Everyone was at home all the time, so television was a big deal back in the days. So kids were stuck on the television, and television show you a lot of really fantastic programs and movies.
Most of those programs were from North America. Disney films, cartoons like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. 80s pop culture was bright and pastel colored, and it made a big impression on a little girl living in a tense environment. The fantasy of TV was like a sanctuary. It allowed Facuta to get in touch with her own creativity.
I think my music is really escape is.
Take the song Tormenta Solar, or Solar Storm, where you can hear 80s influences like Michael Jackson and Madonna. Por mucho tiempo lo guardé. Before Augusto Pinochet took power in 1973, Chile was a poor country known for its rich folk traditions. But that changed. Protest singer Victor Jara was put to death a few days into the dictatorship. Villa Grimaldi, once a famous cultural center, was turned into a detention complex for dissidents. It wasn't exactly that Pinochet wanted to destroy arts and culture. It's that he wanted Chileans to make economic prosperity their top priority.
The sure path to success, the payoff for working hard, was therefore your ability to consume. And that was could only work if you told people that the path to happiness is by shopping.
That's Margaret Power, a professor of history at the University of Illinois. She lived in Chile during the 70s and 80s. Power watched as Pinochet tried to change the way Chileans thought. He wanted Facuta's generation to conform and not challenge authority.
So there was a sense that people should basically not do anything that draws attention to themselves, that they should put their nose to the grindstone, work hard, and they will get ahead.
Chile did grow economically, but that growth came with a cost. Facuta and many of her peers ached for something more.
We grew up with that longing to create fantasy. For me, pop is that.
Facuta's journey into music began about 10 years ago when she bought a used synthesizer. Soon, she met others making similar music.
We started to know each other by the internet or the gigs we had at little places with horrible sound. And we share a lot of influences.
Now there's a burgeoning scene in Santiago made up of do-it-yourself, 80s-derived indie pop acts. Javier Amena, Jepe, and a group called Denver. They direct each other's music videos and produce each other's records, often for very little money.
Now there is really an audience.
Sergio Sia is a Chilean-American who loves this music. He's watching a video of Facuta. She's wearing a one-piece pink jumpsuit. She calls up all her friends, who each answer from different novelty phones. A clear callback to a time before everybody had a mobile device.
This just makes me wish that we talked on these kind of phones more. Like, I want to talk into a hamburger or a giant lip phone or a shoe.
After we watch another video, Sergio has an aha moment.
Man, this is just making me think of all of us Chileans from that age. Like, are all Peter Pans like me? Like, we're all stuck thinking about our childhood and bringing it back now.
But he thinks that despite how much Chilean pop borrows from the U.S., it won't catch on here.
You know, Americans don't really like listening to music that isn't in their language. They're more privileged in a sense because so much music comes from here or is in English.
Chilean pop is making some inroads, though. Just a year ago, Facuta played at South by Southwest in Austin. So, what would Augusto Pinochet and his regime think?
I think they'd hate it.
Margaret Power.
I think that they would really find it the antithesis of what they want the Chilean youth to be like.
But today's Chilean youth may not be listening. Pinochet was voted out of power in 1991. He's cast a long shadow, but times may be changing. The fact that this music exists at all is a sign that people are finally letting go of those decades of repression. At a concert in downtown Santiago, there are a lot of young Chileans with emo glasses and edgy haircuts, all anxious to hear Facuta sing. This is their moment. For Latino USA, I'm Anne Hoffman.
There are many things people in Latin America share as they're growing up. A common history, the Spanish language, maybe Catholicism. But none of those things seems to be quite as universal as the characters and catchphrases created by Mexican comedian Roberto Gómez Bolaños, or as he was popularly known, Chespirito. Chespirito died in his home in Cancun last November at the age of 85. Our producer, Daisy Rosario, tells us why he's remembered as one of the biggest Latin American comedians of all time.
Roberto Gómez Bolaños, Chespirito.
Thousands gathered in Mexico City's Aztec Stadium on November 30th to pay homage to Roberto Gómez Bolaños, best known as Chespirito. Adults had tears in their eyes. Children were dressed as his characters. Gómez Bolaños' nickname, Chespirito, means Little Shakespeare. He got the nickname early in his almost 60-year career as a writer, producer, and star of dozens of films, plays, and children's TV shows. Mexican actor Gael García Bernal grew up on Chespirito's work. He remembers his favorite show.
A mí, mi favorito es el Chapulín Colorado.
Or in English, The Crimson Grasshopper. It's a sort of satire of comic book superhero cliches.
Oh, ¿y ahora quién podrá ayudarnos?
¡Yo!
¡El Chapulín Colorado!
His influence even bled into mainstream U.S. television. El Chapulín was the inspiration behind the Bumblebee Man on The Simpsons. But none of his shows were as iconic as El Chavo del Ocho, or The Kid at the Eight. In this slapstick sitcom, 40-year-old Gómez Bolaños played an orphaned street kid who lived in a barrel. Gael remembers his favorite catchphrase from the show.
O sea, creo que la mejor frase del Chavo del Ocho es la de, es que no me tienen paciencia.
Que no me tienes paciencia.
No one is patient with me, complained El Chavo on every episode when other characters snapped at him. These catchphrases are now a part of Latin American pop culture.
O sea, cada país hizo algo con Chespirito. O sea, en Brasil es un fenómeno aún más grande que en México. Se llama Chávez.
Gael says that just like him, everyone in Latin America grew up watching El Chavo. And he says it's fascinating how every country adopted the orphan child. Even Portuguese-speaking Brazil, where he's called Chávez.
Hola, mi querido Chespirito.
That's Sofia Vergara speaking at a 2012 TV tribute for Chespirito.
Cuatro generaciones de mi familia hemos adorado a todos tus personajes.
Vergara says that four generations of her family have fallen in love with Chespirito's characters. El Chavo premiered in 1971. And even though production for the show ended in 1992, networks across the Americas still air reruns to this day. In fact, in 2012, Forbes reported that the show averaged a whopping 91 million views daily across the Americas. Here in the U.S., a new animated version of El Chavo runs on Univision. And the original show, El Chavo del Ocho, still airs on the Spanish language channel Galavision. And it's still the most popular sitcom on the channel, with kids and adults ages 18 to 49. So even though he is gone, Chespirito's characters will be with us for years to come. For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
Coming up on Latino USA...
Did you see the picture of my grandma and Cesar Chavez up front? He used to eat here.
An iconic cafe shapes California politics and food. Stay with us. No se vayan.
El doctor se confundió, dijo que yo era retrasado. Mi mamá se lo creyó, pobre casi se murió. Menos mal estaba equivocado. Luego fui creciendo, me puse inteligente. En el colegio estaba un año adelantado. No había más que hacer que estar ahí sentado. Qué fácil era antes llegar volando hasta el planeta Marte, atravesando el cielo en una nave.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Sometimes a restaurant is more than just a restaurant. Take, for example, the Mitla Cafe in San Bernardino. It's an economically struggling city just east of Los Angeles. More than half of its population is Latino. Since the Mitla Cafe opened in the 1930s, it's witnessed and helped bring about political change. Lisa Morehouse takes us there.
It's 11 in the morning, and the Mitla Cafe is packed. Co-owner Steve Okendo weaves through tables and booths, joking with customers about baseball and asking after family members.
How's your mom? Is her foot okay?
The menu at Mitla's looks almost exactly like it did when Okendo's great-grandmother, Lucia Rodriguez, started cooking here over 75 years ago. There's menudo, chili rellenos, handmade tortillas, and hard-shell hamburger tacos with cheddar cheese, a kind of Cal-Mex cuisine.
I've been coming here ever since I was a kid, and I really think that this hot sauce is in my bloodstream.
Drew Negretti says once when he came back from 2 months overseas, all he could say was,
I just need to go to Mitla's. It was the first thing I ate, and I think I ate it for like 5 days straight, to be honest with you.
Where's my hat?
Today, Negretti comes in with his parents and runs into half a dozen family members. Community college faculty meet up here. So does the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and the Kiwanis Club and politicians, says Steve Okendo.
And I like to joke with the people running for office that if they don't have their meetings here, they're not going to get elected.
He's only kind of kidding.
Did you see the picture of my grandma and Cesar Chavez up front? He used to eat here.
Politicians and activists have come here since the 1930s. Historian Mark Osegueda, a San Bernardino native, explains what life was like for Latinos then.
So there was school segregation. There was segregation in public theaters. In the workplace, there was the Mexican restrooms and there was the white restrooms.
And there was segregation at the city's only public pool, at a park called Paris Hill.
And Mexicans were only allowed to use it one day out of the week, the day before the pool was meant to be drained and maintained.
Back then, in the 30s and 40s, the restaurant's proprietor, Salvador Rodriguez, rallied the neighborhood's business leaders.
They had formed the Mexican Chamber of Commerce.
Former city councilwoman Esther Estrada.
They would go and meet at Mitla's to discuss the politics of the community.
They sponsored fiestas for important Mexican holidays, dressed in elaborate costumes, and rode horseback in parades where they carried both Mexican and American flags. And the Mitla Cafe was the rare business that could sponsor whole neighborhood baseball teams. At the time, Estrada says, these were political acts.
We come from the 60s and 70s generation. We were raised at a time where it's absolutely proper to hit the streets and advocate. In the 30s and the 40s, maybe in those days it had to be more subtle, but they got things done also.
Local leaders met at the Mitla Cafe to organize. They formed the Mexican-American Defense Committee and sued the city for access to that public pool, says historian Mark Osegueda.
And in 1944, the decision went in favor of the Mexican-American Defense Committee, and it desegregated public pools, parks, and recreational facilities for Mexican-Americans in the city of San Bernardino.
This served as precedent for the case that would desegregate schools in California.
And that, in turn, served as precedent for the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, in 1954.
Those were vibrant days for the Mitla Cafe, recalls waitress Lucy Reyes.
Well, you want to know when I first started working
here?
Yes, I do. 1951, I think.
Route 66 ran down Mount Vernon Avenue, the main street of this part of San Bernardino. Many locals worked in solid manufacturing jobs.
It was real lively. There was a lot of bars up and down the street, little restaurants, but a lot of little businesses. We had a big grocery store at the corner and two tortillerias. Then up the street, we had a bakery. We had the theater, Azteca, all Mexican movies. Pedro Infante, Luis Aguilar.
Then, in 1959, the new freeway opened. There were no exit ramps into the West Side Mexican-American neighborhood.
It was our own Berlin Wall.
Esther Estrada.
It had shut us off from the downtown, brought the demise of our businesses on the West Side.
Last year, off-ramps were added to the freeway's West Side, but those old scars remain. Walk along Mount Vernon Avenue now, and you'll pass empty lots and vacant storefronts.
You know, you see the blight. You see the bars on the window. I don't see that when I come here because I'm from here. But my hood, my barrio, no, it's a beautiful place.
Steve Okendo. Now, there's one other way in which the Mitla Cafe left its mark. It inspired Taco Bell. In the 50s, the man who'd go on to start the fast food chain had a hamburger stand across from Mitla's. He saw how popular their tacos were and learned how to make them. So, does Okendo ever get resentful that his family never saw the dividends?
No, not at all. I wouldn't change where we're at for the world. I really wouldn't. Our customers come here for that gut feeling, that soul feeling, that home feeling. It's a meeting place, and you can't take that away.
For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in San Bernardino, California.
In 2009, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security almost entirely destroyed a place called Friendship Park, which lies on the U.S.-Mexico border. The park is at the westernmost edge of the border, overlooking the Pacific Ocean. It was once a place where families on either side could meet and spend the day together. Now it sits between two heavily fortified border fences, part of a U.S. plan to enhance border security. Access to the area is severely restricted, but reporter Jordana Gustafson takes us there.
Ellos estaban buscando la dirección y no lo encontraron muy rápido. Y anduvieron preguntando y se perdieron como por dos horas, tres horas ahí.
Jorge Perez Perez is standing on the Mexican side of the border looking for his family on the U.S. side. His brother in the U.S. has just called Perez on his cell phone. He's driven 2 hours from Los Angeles with his kids looking for Friendship Park. But they're lost, and Perez isn't sure the gate will still be open by the time they get here. Perez asks me if I think Border Patrol will let his family in anyway. I tell him I don't know. The gate's only open for 4 hours today.
And there are many, many families for whom this is the only place in the world where they can actually see their loved ones.
John Fanastil is a United Methodist pastor from California. He's on the U.S. side of Friendship Park today. I'm on the Mexican side.
Yeah, right now we're looking through this very thick mesh. I really have to change my angle in order to be able to look you in the eye.
I can barely see his face.
It didn't always used to be like this.
When U.S. officials built a second fence here at Friendship Park 4 years ago, they created a no-man's land, a dirt patch 50 yards wide sitting between the two fences. Fana still helped convince U.S. officials to allow people to meet here for a few hours every weekend. And on one Saturday each December for an event called Posada Sin Fronteras.
The Posada Without Borders. Posada is an ancient Mexican ritual in which participants reenact the search of the holy couple Mary and Joseph for a place to stay on the night of Jesus' birth.
At this Posada, families on either side of the border are searching for each other. Those who found their relatives press up against the fence to talk. Others, like Jorge Perez Perez, keep looking.
Ay, ay, ay. Es que mi hermano no saben buscar direcciones muy fácil. Se pierden.
Perez says his brother isn't very good with directions. He's still lost. Perez is here with his mother. She hasn't seen her children on the U.S. side in 5 years. Perez hasn't seen his siblings since he was deported from the U.S. 4 years ago. He says he thinks his brother has GPS.
Yo creo que sí tiene GPS, pero... He probably know how to use it. He don't know how to use it. ¿Cómo puede llegar para acá?
Que tome el freeway 5 hacia el sur.
El freeway 5 hacia el sur.
Y poco antes de llegar a San Isidro.
Poco antes de llegar a San Isidro.
Hay un señalamiento que indica Friendship State Park.
A local reporter helps with directions, but the sun is moving lower in the sky and people are starting to leave the posada. Pretty soon, Perez and his family are the only ones left. Finally, his brother and family find the park, but they're too late. Border Patrol has closed the gate. Perez and his mother run along the fence, looking for a place where it's clear enough to see to the other side. Across the stretch of dirt and weeds, they can just make out the shapes of their family members standing on the other side of the second fence. Perez talks to his family on the U.S. side using the walkie-talkie function on his cell phone. He tells his brother there are visiting hours tomorrow, and maybe they can stay in a hotel nearby. His brother tells him they can't make it back tomorrow. Perez leans his head against the fence, hiding his tears. His mother sobs. Over the phone, her two granddaughters take turns saying hello to her. Hi, Grandma, I'm Michelle, says one girl. Hi, my princess. Take good care of yourselves, her grandmother says.
Soy Brianna.
Hola, hija. Te amo, hija. Las quiero. Que Dios me las bendiga.
Hola,
hija.
I'm Brianna, says the other granddaughter.
Igualmente, mami. Te amo mucho.
I love you, their grandmother says. May God bless you.
Yo también los amo, hijo. Los quiero. Dios me los bendiga.
For Latino USA, I'm Jordana Gustafson in Tijuana, Mexico.
Los amo, los quiero.
And mis queridos, to close out this week's show, we bring you a moment from earlier this year from a conversation I had with actress and legend Rita Moreno. In our interview, Rita opened up about her insecurities that followed her throughout her life, despite her absolute success. Sabiduría now from Rita Moreno.
I mean, I did a play about my life, Life Without Makeup. And I had a real crisis of confidence before we opened. I mean, I couldn't remember any lines. I couldn't say them properly. It was really bad. The artistic director of the theater came over to my house and he says, okay, what's going on? You know, what's happening? And I immediately burst into tears and I said, I don't know. And he says, no, we have to examine this because if we don't find out what's happening here, you're not going to get to opening night in one piece. And I'm sobbing and carrying on. He says, what is it? Are you afraid of something? And I said, I think so. And this is all between sobs. And then he says to me, well, what? And it finally occurred to me. I said, I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint, between sobs. And he looked at me like I was a crazy woman because he thinks I'm one of the most talented women on earth. That weird lack of confidence that's brought on by this dark presence who definitely, obviously still exists in my persona. Amazing, isn't it? Because everybody thinks of me as a person who's so strong. Well, I am, but not necessarily in that way. I never felt confident about myself. Now, that came from my mother, too, because she was a typical ghetto mom in the sense that, oh, hey, don't make waves. You know, be nice. You have to be a good girl. You always have to be a good girl. And if you're a very sensitive child, as I was, that stays with you for a very long time. Don't make waves. Don't have opinions. You just smile and use your cute self to charm everybody. And I was that. I was all of that for far too many years, which is what sent me into therapy eventually.
So does all of this make you feel like the weight of history, responsibility, you've got to do the right thing? No.
Absolutely not. I do what I need to do. And I don't feel that because I have become the role model where I didn't have one. But because of that doesn't mean that I'm going to change my opinion about how I feel about W or the immigration situation. Not at all.
Which actually, as a Puerto Rican woman, you know, you never had to deal with immigration issues. And yet you're the one who's bringing it up and saying that it is a...
Well, listen, it's still part of me. It's part of my history. It doesn't matter that that didn't happen to me. My community is me. I am my community.
And in terms of immigration, what do you see that's happening in your community?
I know I see one thing that is terrific, and that is that the community is really becoming vocal, has become vocal about it, where we didn't for many, many, many years. It was just somehow accepted. We just didn't feel we had the strength. And I remember thinking that when the Black community began to, you know, just speak out, and I thought, why isn't that not happening with us? Isn't that interesting? And I thought, yes, we have part of us has Cesar Chavez, but somehow it doesn't translate to the rest of us. What is happening? Why aren't we doing this? And then one day it just happened. Somebody just said, I've had enough. I have value and I have worth, and I'm going to do my best to see to it that we get that kind of recognition and acknowledgement and respect. And it's wonderful to see. It's great to see.
And we'll be airing a full version of my interview with Rita Moreno next week, where she reflects on her journey from Puerto Rico, her career, and how she handles the little voice in her head when it tells her she can't do something. Be sure to tune in. And for this week, my dear listeners, that's Latino USA. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McBoiler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, we'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_La_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima and happy holidays.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org.
Can we do the happy holidays? Is it too soon?
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org. This is NPR.